Support for Class Dismissed comes from School Status. School Status is the only K-12 data analytics platform designed to turn analysis into engagement. To learn more about how School Status can change your school district, head over to schoolstatus.com. You are listening to Class Dismissed, Episode 5, and I'm your host, Nick Ortego. In one city, teachers are restocking on much-needed school supplies, and it's costing them nothing. We'll explain how. Plus, Colorado is implementing a plan to arm some of their teachers with guns, and teachers reveal the funniest way their students have cheated. Stay with us. Class Dismissed is the podcast that inspires educators through story. We cover some of the hottest topics and news in the world of education. Plus, each week, we'll interview a guest with a bright idea for education that you may be able to apply in your community. This week, we have Noreen Rodriguez. Noreen hated social studies in high school, but she's now dedicated her life to make sure other children never feel the same way. Hey, everybody. Nick Ortego here, and I'm joined with teacher extraordinaire, Lissa Pruitt, and we have Nick Peterman of schoolstatus.com. Lissa, how are you doing?
I'm great.
Nick, welcome back to the show.
Great. Great to be back on.
How'd you like doing your first podcast last week? Was that good?
Yeah, it was. It was interesting. New for me, so exciting.
Well, we appreciate you joining us on the show. Well, we're not going to waste any time. I know our listeners want to get right into the teacher's lounge and hear all the scoop going on around the community. Lissa, what do you know?
Well, this is something super cool out of Baltimore. There's a teacher swap, which I've never heard of, but I think we need to all try to do more of.
Is that like a swap in college where like the sororities and the fraternities get together?
Yes, remember those? Yes, it's a bender. Yes. No, I'm just kidding. It's a teacher supply swap. It's called the Baltimore Teacher Supply Swap. Basically, teachers at the end of the year and truly like, you know, whole school districts can pay a subscription fee. I think it was mentioned $10. They take leftover supplies that they're not using, they bring them to the swap, and then they also shop. It's in an abandoned warehouse, just tons of teachers coming in the Baltimore area to pick up things, even simple things like pencils.
It sounds like a business we need to start.
Actually, I know. Like, I feel like the whole nation needs this because there are things as teachers that you didn't use as the year went on, and it was given to you, but you didn't use it because you didn't need it, but somebody else might need it. And teachers spend so much money on their supplies. I mean, pencils are so tough, especially in January. This would be awesome in January because you're out of so much stuff and they've already brought school supplies. I mean, that was way back, you know? And so here you are in January trying to make sure you have enough stuff to just finish through the year, and a swap of some sort would be so helpful.
So essentially a teacher would go and be like, I got three boxes of Kleenexes. What do you have? And
yeah, pretty much. I mean, the way it was described, I mean, there's lots that you can check up on, read up on, but basically, yeah, a teacher would, you know, have things that even binders, you know, markers, Expo markers, erasers, notebook paper that maybe they didn't get to that year, graph paper. I know when I taught math, when I taught algebra, one year I ended up with like so much graph paper. I thought, wow, okay, I don't ever need graph paper ever again. But I could have taken it somewhere, put it out, shop for some other stuff that I wanted, and basically get to fill up a basket of stuff you need. It's just an exchange.
Nick, have you ever heard of this?
No, I've not heard of it, but I can tell you I would have made a run on those Expo markers when I was teaching. I taught geometry, like five sections of geometry, because that was the course that, you know, the math teachers wanted to take. You know, they wanted to teach. So I spent a lot of time drawing figures and then erasing them and redrawing them. So, yeah, I would have loved to have had something like that around.
How much does a teacher spend out of their own pocket a year? Just give me like a rough estimate, each of you.
Man, I mean,
it's got to be around, I would say anywhere from $300 to $500.
Yeah, I would say for me, but I mean, what I teach is a little different and it is a little more expensive. It's constantly changing and constantly consumable, but you know, I would say close to 800.
I don't understand why my tax dollars don't funnel into the class. Like, how is that not happening? Like, help me as just like a person who's not in the education system understand that.
If I had to guess, like, why, and this is like a really nice answer, okay?
Okay.
if I had to guess why that's not translating, I have worked places where I never had a shortage of paper.
Okay.
And then I've worked places where, yeah, like they would come and tell the teachers, hey, cut back on the photocopies. You can't have any more copies for the month. I mean, it's really comes down to that. If I had to guess why, it's because it's hard to predict. It's hard to predict how much paper you're really going to need. So they don't want to buy an over amount of paper, maybe. Maybe I'm being like really kind here by saying this. But also, I mean, reams of paper are now on school supply lists where you have to bring in 2 reams of paper.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, parents are buying it and they're bringing it. And it's kind of like...
I know. And it adds up. It's so expensive.
I'm naive, I guess.
One year I spent on my own child... like $130 was their school supply list. When I got everything on the list with nothing flashy, you know, that, you know, I'm sure across the nation, some are less and some are higher than that as far as a school supply bill. But yeah, I mean, that's the thing is like one of the things that this teacher swap was paper and pencils. Even if they were already sharpened pencils, the teachers don't care. They just need pencils. I became such a psycho in my class this last year. I put duct tape around my pencils so that throughout the school I
You're
would
like a
notice
bank. That's what the banks do.
But the thing is I got all the kids on it because in the art class, you know, if they're coming, they just walk out with their pencils and they don't realize it. And then at the end of the day you have no pencils. And so I duct taped. It took me a while to get just at the top of the pencil. So
do you like duct
I told,
tape a flower to it? Like
no,
you do,
it
like
was the... you know, duct tape is so cool now. They have all these different patterns. So it was splatter painted duct tape. And basically I told the kids, hey, listen, if you see one of these around the school, it's mine. Like, bring it back. Please help me. Bring it back. And so at the end of the day, I would have kids running saying, Miss Lisa, I have one of your pencils. I have one of your pencils. I was like, thank you so much.
Well, pencils for me were, that was the thing, you know. For me, it was the markers and then for the kids. And, you know, it's such a disruption let's say you're teaching 30 kids, which I often did. And, you know, every day one of them doesn't have a pencil. That's something you have to go through every day. So I would just get stacks of pencils and I just would say, look, here are the pencils. Don't ask me for a pencil. Get one when you come in so we can get our routine started. And if you need a pencil, take a pencil, you know, but don't just come in here every day because you need a pencil. Keep up with it. And that seemed to work for a little while in the first part of the class, but as things, you know, progressed, you know, that was kind of like the pencil store that they didn't have to pay for. And it got harder and harder to keep those pencils. So you're right, Lisa. About January, you know, things were looking pretty bleak over there. So
yeah.
If they ever wanted to bring me Christmas presents, I would say, bring me pencils.
Yes, and erasers. Because that's the other thing is like these tiny little erasers on the pencils, especially when, you know, you're teaching algebra where they're going to erase a ton or art where they're going to erase a ton. And so you have a perfectly good pencil and no eraser. So that's a useless pencil. It might as well be a pen at that point, you know, because you can't erase.
This whole January concept's interesting to me. Maybe they should like do 2 school supply lists. Just cut the first one in half and you get an infusion and then you get another infusion in January. Is that a crazy idea? Or
I have heard of schools that do a, you know, a mid-year list and it's less, it's much, much less.
Mm-hmm.
It's more basic, like just basically pencils, erasers, things like that. But again, I want to say, I think they're every, you know, community out there should start a teacher swap. I mean, they basically started it in a church, I think. And then they got so big that they started it, you know, they rolled over into a larger area.
The teacher swap is an excellent idea. Hopefully someone's going to hear this and be like, you know, we'll start this in our community.
I know.
And
I think
it just
so.
Makes sense. You know, I really like it. Nick, I know you've got a story that's a little bit on the heavier side, if you will.
Yeah, this one was pretty interesting. I ran across it on the BBC, and it's talking about Colorado arming teachers in the classroom. And so we know that's a kind of controversial, but this is a program where they're taking, it's sort of an extension of the concealed carry laws that they have there in Colorado. And what they're doing is they've created this course called Faculty Administrators Safety Training and Emergency Response. So it's an acronym for FASTER. And so I think the idea there is to be able to have these people in place that do have weapons so that if something were to happen, as we've seen, that there would be someone already there who could address perhaps a shooter on scene or something like that. It's really tough. I'm got to be honest with you. I'm all over the place on this one as far as, you know, what I think. I do think that, you know, sometimes when we have these school zones where no guns are allowed, as a criminal or someone who's intending to do a lot of harm, you know, that would be like a prime target because they know that there's a set amount of time that they're probably going to be able to inflict their horror. So, I do think sometimes then, and maybe that's not the wrong thing. And, you know, we've had actually what are called SRO officers who are actual police officers on campuses throughout America since the 60s, I believe it is. So it's not like we haven't had guns on campus. I think the thing here and the concern is here is that, you know, these are teachers. And so, their job is to be teaching kids.
Correct me if I'm wrong. They're kind of saying we'll have a concealed weapon, maybe in a safe or something in a classroom or in somewhere in the building, and there'll be certified people to use it if need be, God forbid.
That's correct. And these are people you got to remember who have been through the concealed carry courses that you have to take to be able to do that by law. And so this is an extension of that. It's a 3-day course that includes law enforcement officers and other crisis management folks that help them. It's beyond just the having the gun. It's more about a emergency response to anything, including an active shooter situation.
You know, I know there's going to be a lot of strong opinions about this. In fact, I posted this story just in our Twitter feed this morning, and we did get a response back from one of our listeners. They said, quote, "Let's try arming teachers with funding and professional development before districts get into this." So obviously that's one person who's like, this isn't a good idea. But I'm going to play something from 60 Minutes on CBS. This is actually back in 2015, and it was just about active shooters, and not necessarily in a school, but just active shooters anywhere. And the interview was with Anderson Cooper and D.C. Police Chief Kathy Lanier. And I don't know if that's the same police chief as today, but take a look, or take a listen rather, to this interview, and we'll talk about it on the other side.
Your options are run, hide, or fight.
That's what you tell people they should do.
Yes. What we tell them is the facts of the matter is that most active shooters kill most of their victims in 10 minutes or less. And the best police department in the country is going to be about a 5 to 7 minute response. I always say if you can get out, getting out's your first option, your best option. If you're in a position to try and take the gunman down, to take the gunman out, it's the best option for saving lives before police can get there. And that's, you know, that's kind of counterintuitive to what cops always tell people, right? We always tell people don't take action, call 911, don't intervene in the robbery. We've never told people take action. This is a different scenario.
That interview to me, I don't want to say it changed my, well, it did. It changed my perspective. I don't know if it changed my actual end result and what I think, but when I heard that interview, you know, I didn't grow up in a big gun culture type household. But you hear that, it's a different scenario with active shooters. And like she said, people are getting killed in the first 10 minutes. The best police stations in the country are going to take 7 minutes to get there. I used to work at a news station, and we would call the police when we would have somebody who would come to the station and just seem disturbed or whatever, 20, 30 minutes sometimes before somebody would get out there. And we'd go, you know what? What if something was going on here?
I did a mini session, a professional development earlier this year on crisis, kind of, you know, as a teacher, what to do. And it's so scary, but things are different now than they used to be as far as what they want us to do. This training I went through, it showed footage or even had, you know, documentation from multiple school shootings, and it pointed out things that teachers did that helped save lives, and basically said, you know, okay, there were this many children in this room, and because this teacher did this, these children were not harmed, but this classroom, I mean, it was just like so shocking to know, like, oh my goodness, you know, we are so responsible for the education of these children, but we are also responsible for their safety. They asked for a raise of hands, who in this room of these teachers would be willing to go towards an intruder, mm-hmm. and who would not, you know, raise your hand, be honest, would you feel comfortable? And so few teachers, you know, raise their hand because it's not something that we've been trained in. It's not something that, you know, back in the day when you said, I'm going to be this adorable little teacher, you know, you're not thinking those things, mm-hmm. but it is, you know, I know that, you know, yeah, what, you know, would I want to be one of the teachers on staff that was able to, or, you know, had the responsibility of operating a firearm? No, I know my limits and I wouldn't be that teacher, but these workshops and these things that are going around to help us with crisis management, I think there's so much that you can learn. And I mean, I might, in a situation, I would maybe feel good that to know that somebody else on campus knew where the firearm was and knew how to use it.
You know, and the article talked a lot about, you know, different people have different views. So it did talk about the two different groups out there. And, you know, they were saying that that they were creating these victim zones, so to speak, because, you know, the people, the shooters would know that, or the people that were coming to do harm would know that there's nobody on campus there. And so, you know, I always think about these home detection systems that everybody's getting nowadays with the cameras and stuff. It used to be that you would get this company that would have a sign that would say home protected by whatever. And instead of paying the millions of dollars for the system, I always would just want the sign.
Mm-hmm. You know, that would say,
hey, let me just stick the sign out in the yard, and that'll let people know that that they shouldn't come around. So it's a tough question. I think these guys have decided that this is a local thing, and so it's not the answer for every community, but I think they've decided that it's an answer for theirs.
Yeah, it's definitely a heavy topic, but I think it's a discussion worth having. And I'm sure there's probably some folks, listening on their iPods or in their cars, and they're probably talking to the car right now because, you know, everyone's got a strong opinion about it. And I'll try to lighten things up here a little bit. We're going to talk about cheating. Okay, there was Reddit, as you guys know, is just, you know, it's a great forum, and people just always chime in. Well, apparently someone got on Reddit and was like, "All right, teachers of the world, tell me your best cheating stories," and there's some pretty good ones in there. I'll give you an example of one. This one writer hopped on there and said that she taught at a private school in India, and there was one girl covered in henna tattoos, and she said the student actually inscribed all the answers into the decorative hennas. So, like, from a distance, it just looked like a decorative tattoo, but really it was the answers for the test. Nick, does this happen a lot?
Well, you know, I spent 10 years in the classroom, and I was never really, I got to the point where I was never really surprised at any effort that was a student had to make, to cheat. There was just a variety of them. And so I was, you know, a typical math teacher, so I did a lot of multiple choice testing. And so I would have an answer key for all my tests, and I would leave one laying on the ground that had all of the complete wrong answers. And I would just leave it laying kind of shoved up under a desk so that it looked like it was an accident for it to be there. And I just would let the kids come in. And as they come in, I would say, "Hey, I hope you guys are ready for your tests. We practiced, we've studied, we're ready to go here. Let's get going." And it would be real upbeat. And I would just kind of make sure my attention was directed away from where it was. And I would watch, you know, invariably one student would pick it up, and I would go through the routine of getting ready, and I would kind of, you know, how teachers have the eye in the back of their head. We truly do that. And so, I would watch them kind of pass it around and, look at each other and watch that. And then I'd go ahead and pass the test out. And I'd wait about 5 minutes into it, and I would say, "Oh, look, by the way, I left a fake key out on the ground. So if you got that, it's going to be all the wrong answers." And they all start laughing and giggling. And so it kind of lightened up the tone and let them know that
don't mess with Nick.
I have been lucky not to have too many cheaters. There was one student once that kept dismissing themselves to the restroom, claiming that they were suffering from diarrhea, but really it wasn't. But really, other than that, nah. I'm that gullible teacher, though, that would be like, yeah, they're not cheating.
In other words, there's cheating going on, and you just don't know it. Let me tell you about this one, and I'm going to almost read this verbatim from Reddit, but the guy says, "One time, one of my buddies stole the final out of the teacher's desk when she wasn't looking. He said, we took the test home, and we used the textbooks to get all the answers. And since it was multiple choice, I decided to make a coded keychain with colored beads on it." She said the keychain was 50 beads long and was color coded to reflect the correct answers in chronological order. For instance, red was A, and blue was B, and yellow was C, and green was D.
Gosh.
And then they attached it to the car keys and just left the keys on top of the desk when they took the test. She says the teacher even walked by to hand out the test and complimented the keychain.
Oh.
And she said, "I told her my little sister made the keychain for me." She says, "I didn't even have a little sister."
So, oh, my goodness.
So maybe not morally right, but what's funny is sometimes people will spend so much time trying to find a way to cheat, they just would have studied.
I remember the first time I cheated, the only time I've ever cheated.
So you have cheated.
I've only cheated once in my life, but I was in third grade on a spelling test. I didn't know how to spell the word, and I looked on my neighbor's paper, and then I felt so bad about it that I went back and told the teacher afterwards that I cheated on that word, and she said she knew because we spelled it the exact same wrong way.
Nick, did you ever cheat in school?
I did. I had a calculus teacher who was completely deaf, and you know, our whole entire class would when we took our tests, we would keep our heads straight, we would keep our heads down, and as long as we could talk in that manner, we could say, hey, what's number four, and that kind of thing. But calculus being the kind of course that it is, you know, it was never really A, B, C, or D, so we had to do a lot more talking. But he knew what was going on, and so I think he created a situation where we would have to collaborate to take the tests. And, you know, it wasn't like we all made hundreds and we had people that did terrible. So it's still, we still had representative grades. And I actually was able to use that sort of method into college when we would go and have take-home tests, and we would work collaboratively together on that, which is really a model of what you have to do in the workplace. So I'm going to kind of put a spin on it and say, yeah, I cheated, yeah, but it worked out good.
Yeah, you're trying to make it look positive. No. Okay, Nick Ortego, have you ever cheated on a test?
You know what time it is? I think it's time for our Bright Idea segment.
Okay, I see.
Hey, so let me ask you, has there ever been a subject, Lissa, that you just hated?
Yes.
What was that?
Language, like...
Like Spanish or...
No, like arts? Language, like where you have to like diagram sentences.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, our guest in our Bright Idea segment, she hated social studies, and she's now trying to do something to change that and make sure it never happens to another child. So we're going to go ahead and bring her in here in our Bright Idea segment. In our Bright Idea segment, we have Noreen Rodriguez. Noreen hated social studies in high school, so she's been dedicating her life to fixing it. Noreen, welcome to Class Dismissed. How are you doing?
Good. How are you all? Good to be here.
We're doing great on this end. You know, I was reading a little bit about you, and I thought, I've got to get you on the Class Dismissed show here. You have a master's in curriculum and instruction and a doctorate in curriculum and instruction, specializing in social studies education, all from the University of Texas in Austin. But you were not really a fan of social studies in high school. So how did that happen?
Oh, I hated social studies. I thought it was the worst. So I went to school in Texas, K-12, and I don't think I had very strong feelings either way about social studies until my high school American history class. And the teacher one day, and kind of randomly, she asked, Noreen, where are your people from? And she didn't ask that question to anybody else. She just asked me. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really know how to respond to that because I wasn't sure what she was getting at. I didn't understand what she meant. I didn't understand how that was relevant to anything we had been talking about. But it just seemed very clear that she was singling me out and I was not viewed as normal somehow. And as the class kind of progressed, it just was very clear that everything we were learning about in that particular class had nothing to do with me or anyone that I knew. And so I just tuned out, and kind of from then on, I made it a point to not take history ever again if I could help it. I graduated from UT in undergrad with a bilingual education degree. Mm-hmm. And then I got my master's while I was teaching. And shortly after finishing my master's program, I was invited to participate in the Tejano History Curriculum Project. So Tejanos are the people who lived in Texas for hundreds of years when it was Mexico, and then once it became its own country, we're very proud of that in Texas. Mm-hmm. And then once it became part of the United States, and all along, Texas used to be the state of Coahuila y Texas. And so there are people that have lived there for generations, and their history is somehow completely omitted from Texas history. The vast majority of what you learn in fourth grade Texas history is about Anglo settlers and their legacy. You don't really learn about people of color in any sort of substantive way at all.
So kind of the story I've always heard is the Mexicans were fighting Davy Crockett in the Alamo, but you're saying the Tejanos were actually fighting alongside Davy Crockett. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. There are Tejanos at the Battle of the Alamo. There are Tejanos in that early Texas government once Texas had its own independence. But prior to the Battle of the Alamo, there was another battle initiated by the Tejanos for Texas independence that didn't include Anglos. It didn't include those settlers that had come from the United States, but we don't learn about that history.
And so what was that point? What was the time that you said, you know what, I'm going to do something about this. Was it right
So
then?
I think that whole project, just being able to recognize that there's this vast history about our state that none of us in our state learn about, was really eye-opening. And then the fact that all of my students were really deeply engaged in it, regardless of their own family's heritage and race, they cared about this history. But that wasn't my history. I am Asian American. And once I started my doctorate program, so I was already 34, that was the first time I ever learned about Asian American history. And that was when I really had this moment where I thought, wow, I never learned anything that explained how there was an immigration law in 1965 that allowed my parents to come from Asia to the United States. That was never something we learned about.
I read somewhere about the Philippines, or who actually maybe came to the United States before maybe the Europeans did, and a lot of people don't even realize that. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. I want to double check the date, but I'm fairly certain that in 1587, the first Filipinos landed in Morro Bay, California. And so that's before the Pilgrims. That is before the United States was the United States. And so there's this rich history of Asians coming to the United States. In the 1700s, there were settlements founded in Louisiana by Filipinos that jumped off Spanish galleons, and they married African Americans, some people who were freed slaves. And then in a little bit later, in the 1800s and 1900s, there were Punjabi Sikhs that were working in agriculture in California that married Mexican women. And so there's these fascinating histories of these little pockets of people who came for various reasons across the United States. And so when I was in high school and my teacher asked me, where are your people from? It was very clear that my people were not viewed as people from here.
So what do we do as teachers? What do we do to, you know, because obviously there's so many schools across the nation that have a wonderful mix of all different types of people that are wondering about the history of their people. What do we do about that?
I think there's a lot of things that we need to do. And the first thing that I think is most important is recognizing that the textbook isn't going to ever be enough.
Right.
I mean, one of the activities I do with my undergrads who are seeking teacher certification is just look through the state standards to see which individuals are listed, and we categorize them in several different ways. But sadly, regardless of what grade level you're looking at, the vast majority of historical individuals that our students are supposed to learn about are white men of money who had power. So we're ignoring working classes, we're ignoring women, we're ignoring most people of color, we're ignoring people with disabilities, we're ignoring people from LGBTQ populations. Like, the vast majority of us are not represented in those textbooks. So I think that's the first step, just recognizing that what we are handed by our school districts will never be enough. And also we know that most of the times it's not particularly interesting. And when students see themselves in what they're learning, they're much more engaged.
What's the next step for you? Are you just trying to inform incoming teachers, or do you want to go and change the textbooks? What's your plan?
So I work at a few levels because I think it's important to recognize that there are a lot of areas that need change. I teach future teachers in social studies, and so that's certainly one area in which I try to make an impact every semester. And I also look at children's literature as a vehicle, because I think particularly as a former elementary teacher, children's literature can be such a wonderful way to bring those histories to students in a way that's really accessible and engaging. So I do presentations for in-service teachers. I do presentations and professional development at the school district level. I'm all over the place. I'm trying to share this with as many people as I possibly can.
And what's the feedback you get?
Every time I've done a PD, a professional development, and I've spoken to teachers afterwards about what they've done, they've always been really excited about it. So they've seen the value in it, and they just want to do more. And so I think one of the things that is super important in this kind of work is making sure that the teachers themselves feel comfortable with the content and their own content knowledge, so that when they teach it to kids, they know that they're doing it with accuracy and that they're being respectful of the histories and the cultures that they're talking about if they're not insiders themselves.
You know, with the area, this high stakes testing environment that we're in, do you get a lot of pushback in terms of you know, this isn't going to be on the test and that sort of information from teachers? Is that a fight or a challenge for you?
I taught fifth grade, and in Texas, fifth grade out of all of the elementary grades has more required tests than any other. And so I recognize that the very best way to make sure that social studies, which is not a tested grade in Texas, gets covered is to integrate it with language arts. Mm-hmm. And that's part of why I really push children's literature as a tool for teachers, because you can use a book that's historical fiction, you can use a book that's historical nonfiction to support those skills that students have to know in order to pass the test. And so I think part of why teachers have been receptive to the kinds of professional developments that I offer is because I absolutely have that in mind. But I also think it can make the testing life easier even, because your students are learning about stuff they've never seen before. It's interesting. It's engaging. They want to figure out how these pieces of the puzzle have been missing for so long.
Yeah, you know, that's a great idea, because so much of this testing stuff is where they have to read a short passage and then answer questions and make an inference and make a connection to something else that was not even in the passage. So by inserting these smaller stories of time that have been omitted, you know, it does allow them practice. How would a school district, if they wanted to invite you to do some professional development or something for their teachers, how would they go about getting you in front of their teachers?
I have a website. It is naseemrdz.com, NASEEMRDZ.com. So people can contact me there. And then also on the website for teachers, because really teachers are the people that I think are on the front lines of this, and really they're going to be the ones that make the change. And I have children in public school. I deeply believe in our country's public schools. And so on my website, I also have lists of children's literature and links to different lesson plans for both Latino history and for Asian American history. Part of my goal with my website and with the work that I do is to cluster all those resources so that teachers can say, hey, I want to teach about Chinese exclusion in the 1800s, but how do I do that for elementary kids? And they can go to my website and all that stuff's already laid out.
Yeah, that is helpful, definitely, for teachers. That's super helpful.
So, Noreen, you've dedicated all these years to social studies. Do you love it now?
I kind of do.
Oh, no.
I will admit, there are certainly some areas of history where if I were on Jeopardy, I would fail miserably. The Civil War, for example, is just something I'm not into the wars.
Well, Noreen, we really appreciate you sharing your experience and your perspective with us and our listening audience. Are you ready for our pop quiz?
I think I am, yes.
All right, here we go. If students could only go to school for one subject, which subject would it be? And I don't know what you're going to say here. I have no idea.
Is language arts one subject?
Yeah, I think so.
Language arts.
All right. What are we not teaching in school that we should be teaching?
Citizenship.
Elaborate on that for me a little bit. I'm interested.
I think sometimes we conflate citizenship with patriotism, and so we think we've said the Pledge of Allegiance in the morning and we've told our students to be good citizens of the school, but I think expanding our understandings of what it means to be a citizen and a part of a community is incredibly important. And I think we're seeing right now in this political moment that we have very conflicting ideas of what it means to be an American. And I think there's lots of different ways one can be an American. And if we could reinforce that at an early age and emphasize why it's so important for us to be able to survive in this democracy and to understand each other and empathize with each other, even if we don't agree with each other, I think we'd be in a much better place.
What does every child deserve?
To see themselves in what they learn.
What's the biggest challenge for today's educators?
Respect.
What's the best gift to give an educator?
Appreciation.
What career path would you take if you couldn't be in education?
I'd be an artist.
There you go. That's like Lissa here. we've got what teacher changed your life?
Her name is Dolly Jamail, and I actually wrote about her on a piece connected to the Aussie article, actually. She was my mentor teacher my first year teaching.
What'd she do that really stuck out with you?
She taught me how to survive. she taught me how to create sub plans. She taught me how to engage my students while we were walking in line. She taught me how to do everything. I mean, she completely denies it, but I owe my finishing my first year to Dolly Jamail.
When you're at a school, do you buy the school lunch or bring your own?
I always bring my own unless it's Thanksgiving meal day, and then I will always eat the Thanksgiving
that
meal.
That is always is so good, good at
it's
the good. School.
The turkey with, like, yes, right over the stuffing or the dressing
the
or whatever
good
you call
stuffing,
it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, I could, you know, I would go to a school just to eat that, I think.
Well, and they have all the stuff, and you don't have to do any work. It's
yeah.
perfect.
Yeah.
What do you do on your planning period? Do you have a planning period? I guess you're not actively a teacher.
No, but when I did have my planning period, I would always eat and then maybe be productive and make copies or maybe check email, but I was always eating.
Last question, pen or pencil?
Pen. Fine point.
All right. Noreen, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us and sharing your story. We really appreciate you calling into Class Dismissed.
Thank you so much.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. That's going to do it for episode 5 of Class Dismissed. We want to hear from you, so if you want to send us an idea or comment, remember you can email us at info@classdismissed.com. We want to thank a few 5-star reviews. MelLad12 says the format is simple, the content is motivating and relevant with timely topics and interesting guests. Revolutionize your pedagogy by subscribing. Thank you, Mel. And DC Tech Teacher says, I found myself talking to the car while listening to the podcast. I disagreed with some of the points and thought some were perfect. As a teacher, that's the point, right? Yes, that's exactly right, DC Tech Teacher. We appreciate you listening and thank you both again for the 5-star reviews on iTunes. Don't forget, you can connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/classdismissedpodcast or on Twitter. Just search for us by typing in Class Dismiss, or you can head over to our website at classdismissedpodcast.com. On behalf of Nick Peterman with School Status and Lissa representing all the teachers out there, I'm Nick Ortego, and I'll talk with you next week.
Class Dismissed.